The Siege of New Hampshire series by Mick Rowland. Book 6, The Summer of Wood and Iron. Chapter 7, A Stop in Concord.
Are you sure you have everything?
Margaret lifted the flap on Martin's backpack to peer inside. She spoke quietly to avoid waking the sleepers.
I think so. It's only supposed to be 2 days of work. I packed for 4, just in case.
I still don't like it, Margaret folded her arms. You'll be so far away.
Even if we gave you Walter's handheld ham, you'd still be too far away to use it. What if you needed help?
Martin was about to point out that Charles's truck would be up there with them. She would have no quick way of getting help to him. But telling her that she would be no help didn't seem kind. Instead, he invoked history.
Well, people have gone on long trips away from home for thousands of years and been just fine.
Except for those who were eaten by bears and were never heard from again.
She finished with that little look that says, and what about that?
Martin rolled his eyes. I'll be with Charles and Tyler and working around all the other people that this Farnham guy has working for him. That should discourage the bears. I'll be okay. But will you?
Margaret sighed and looked out the bay window.
The road, driveway, and front walk were becoming more visible as the pre-dawn light grew.
I guess I'll be too busy to worry all that much. Thanks for rearranging people's projects and such. I will feel better with Dustin and Carlos working around the house instead of on that Lloyd guy's place.
Well, I wouldn't be going on this trip if I didn't think there was a good chance it'll pay off for us.
Martin was talking to himself more than Margaret.
Additional firewood would be nice, she answered, though I don't know how much value it'll have for trading. Folks around here don't have much of anything extra to trade for it.
Well, maybe at harvest time there'll be more. If not, then more fish or salt from the coast.
Martin shifted his position, trying to see the road through the gaps in the trees.
I'd better go wait by the road. I don't want Charles beeping his horn while the others are sleeping.
After a lingering hug, in which neither wanted to be the first to let go, Martin hefted up his gear and pushed the door open quietly. The pre-dawn air was surprisingly damp and chilly for midsummer. He pulled on his jacket.
First hints of fall, he muttered to himself.
Oh, hey, Mr. S.
Andy stood up in the box, the lookout post beside the garage.
Oh, time to go, huh?
He stepped over the plywood sides.
Well, mind if I sit with you while you wait for your ride?
He didn't wait for an answer, but laid a square of cardboard on the dewy grass and sat beside the stone steps.
Because I've been meaning to ask you about something.
Martin would have preferred silence so he could hear Charles coming, though, in truth, the old Ford would never be able to sneak up on anyone.
Well, what's your question, Andy? Hey, okay, cool. So, Mrs. S. was telling me about what you were saying to her that Mara said to you when you saw her a while back.
Whoa, that sounded kind of peripherally third-hand there, didn't it?
Oh, anyhow, Mara said that she wasn't into gardening?
Yep, she said she'd rather trade meat for grains and veggies than grow them.
Oh, hey, thanks for confirming my third-hand intel. But on the assumption that it was true and all, I've been thinking that it's just another proof that we're like, soulmates.
Martin looked at Andy with one raised eyebrow.
Oh, don't you see? Continued Andy. It's like we were made for each other. Oh, yeah, she's got the hunting skills. I've got the gardening and the foraging skills. She bags the proteins and I raise the carbs. Vitamin A, vitamin B, riboflavin. Well, you get the idea. She's the hunter and I'm the gatherer. Pretty cool, right? I'm the yang for her yin.
I guess so. Martin didn't want to encourage Andy. But her yin doesn't seem to be looking for a yang.
Andy dismissed the thought with a wave.
Oh, that's just the remnants of her post-imperialist radical feminism. But no amount of neoclassical Marxist deconstructionalism can negate the power of... soulmates.
He nodded enthusiastically at his own assessment.
Aha, Martin responded skeptically.
I hear Charles's truck coming. Gotta go.
He stood, slung the backpack over his shoulder, and the carbine over his other.
As he strode out to the road, he walked backward to offer a last bit of advice. Don't do anything rash. Just remember how she threw you across the little river that last time you tried to, negate her post-structural whatever you said. Charles slowed the truck to a crawl as it passed the end of the driveway. The new generator welder trailer trundled closely behind the truck, so Martin had to grab the end post of the flatbed and swing himself up. Tyler, in the flatbed, to feed the gasifier, lent Martin a hand, climbing in. Tyler sat back down with his back against the cab. Martin was puzzled that Tyler didn't hop down and climb in the cab at the almost stop in front of his house. Two people weren't needed to feed the gasifier. I can take over feeding in the chips.
That's okay, replied Tyler flatly. Fresh air feels good.
He stared over the side fences. If by fresh you mean chilly, well then yeah. Martin zipped his jacket all the way up. The wind chill from the truck's speed made the cool, damp air feel all the colder. What's up?
Oh, Charles and I have been arguing, and I'm tired of it. So I'll let him have the cab all to himself for a while.
Arguing about what? Martin sat with his back to the cab, too. It provided some shelter from the cool breeze.
Tyler shook his head as he spoke. Oh, this whole railroad thing. He jumped in and signed me up without even asking if I thought it was a good idea or not.
I gather you don't?
Nope, total boondoggle. We should be finishing up those new trailers and dealing for wood for our mega load to the coast. Instead, we're wasting 2 or 3 days up north. Beyond that, we've got work to do around the farm, and I don't like leaving Mom alone.
Well, Martin was in the uncomfortable position of somewhat agreeing with both brothers. He also felt like the railroad project could turn out to be an elaborate failure and therefore a waste of their time. On the other hand, there was a chance that it succeeded. Investment usually meant taking risks.
Well, I know what you mean, Martin said. Still, there's a chance it'll work out.
And if it does, you'll have an even better supply of wood for your coastal trades. Tyler folded his arms and scowled.
Yeah, if.
Martin didn't try to keep up any conversation. Tyler seemed to need some quiet time to stew. Having a sullen travel partner made the trip feel longer. As they rolled down the long downhill grade toward the Indian Lakes area, the truck's engine growled and bucked with engine braking. That was normal enough, but the squeal of the brakes wasn't. Both men peered over the cab to see why. Near the bottom of the hill sat a string of 4 sawhorses strung across the road. Behind them stood a thin man with an AR, the butt perched on his hip, barrel to the sky. The man held out his offhand, palm out. Both Martin and Tyler ducked down and pulled their weapons close.
A robber's roadblock? Martin asked.
I haven't heard of any robbers operating around here.
Tyler shook his head.
Don't think it's robbers. Sawhorses are a feeble barricade for robbers. They usually want something that'll make you stop. Still, get ready. There could be more robbers hiding in the woods.
As the truck slowly rolled to a stop, Martin squatted down and peered through the stake bed fence with his carbine at low ready. He scanned the woods to the left. Tyler positioned himself similarly, scanning the right. The young man with the AR swaggered up to the driver's side window.
Go around and go back. No access through here.
Well, what? Why? Asked Charles. What's going on?
It doesn't matter, quipped the young man. Nobody is allowed through. Now go back.
His dismissive tone annoyed Martin, and he wasn't even speaking to him. He could imagine the already grumpy Charles starting to fume.
Well, what's the deal? Demanded Charles. We've been through here lots of times.
His tone was getting harsh.
Look, jerk face.
The young man backed up a step and brought the AR to low ready position. Tyler slapped his hand on the top of the cab. The young man glanced up to see Tyler's rifle aimed at him. Martin knocked on the wooden side fence of the flatbed. He had his carbine aimed at the man, too.
I don't like people calling my brother names, said Tyler.
The young man's eyes flitted from Tyler to Martin and back to Charles, who had drawn his pistol amid the distraction.
Hey, look, I'm just doing my job.
The young man's voice had lost its swagger.
They told me not to let people in.
Well, who are they? Martin asked. Before the young man spoke, the sound of men walking through the brush caught everyone's attention. Two men emerged from the woods on the left side of the road.
Oh, whoa now, said the lead man as he saw all the guns drawn. Yeah, what's going on here?
The man behind him reached for his holster, but the lead man gestured not to. He held his hands out from his sides to show that he was not escalating the situation. Tyler spoke first.
We were going to drive through here, on this public highway, going on about our legal business, when this boy told us we couldn't, started brandishing and calling my brother a jerkface.
Evan? Asked the lead man.
These guys were going to drive into the area, said the young man, without taking his eyes off the muzzles before him. The lead man shook his head like a disappointed father.
Ah, well, I apologize for my assistant's, zeal at his job. We are trying to redirect traffic around the lakes as part of cleaning up the area. Got to keep people from trying to live in these woods and all.
The more the man spoke, the more his voice sounded familiar to Martin. He couldn't place where or when he heard the voice. He stood up with his carbine, aimed low and far left, to add to the de-escalation.
Excuse me, but have we met before?
The man chuckled to himself and shrugged.
Well, maybe. I've met a bazillion people in the past few months, so probably. My name's Davy. Davy Walsh.
Martin's face lit up.
That's it! I thought I recognized your voice. Oh, you've changed a bit since I saw you last. Well, you didn't have the beard. I'm Martin Simmons. You gave me and, you and your brother Leo gave me a ride on the running board of your truck on the way out of Boston. Remember? And a few months back, you helped me get some medicine for my wife.
Oh, hey, yeah, I remember you now.
He turned to the young man.
Okay, Evan, put it away, and don't go around calling people jerkface.
What, do you know everybody? Tyler quipped quietly. First that Varney nutcase, and now some random guy comes out of the woods and your old friends?
Martin ignored him and continued talking to Davy. We're not stopping or doing anything around the lakes, just trying to drive through on our way up to Lincoln.
Driving? Where did you get gas that hadn't gone bad? Outside of the guardsmen, I haven't seen a car or a truck driving in a long time.
Well, no gasoline. We use wood gas, made out of chips. Martin pointed to the gasifier.
Oh, cool. Wait, you're going to drive this thing up to Lincoln? Like through Concord?
Oh, well, yeah, that's the plan.
Hey, could I, catch a ride with you? I'm supposed to be up in Concord by the end of the day tomorrow, but I'm totally not looking forward to a day on horseback.
Martin turned to Tyler.
Well, it's your truck, your call. Charles, Tyler called down, it's your project.
Ah, whatever, grumbled Charles. If it'll get us back on the road quickly, then yeah, whatever. We've lost a lot of time sitting here.
Ah, cool, said Davy. Jimmy, you and Evan finish checking out the South Shore, and,
Davy leveled a stare at Evan,
stick to the rules. No more shooting at shadows in the woods. Report back to the field station when your loop is done.
The other two men pulled away a pair of sawhorses so the truck could pass. Davy climbed onto the flatbed.
Could we make a quick stop by that intersection? I need to get my stuff.
During the ride along the lake toward the four-way stop intersection, Davy posed dozens of questions about the gasifier and its workings. Martin tried to keep the answers simple, but each answer seemed to spawn four more questions. The truck slowing to a stop interrupted the tutorial.
This is it here.
Davy leaned over the wooden rail and called down to Charles.
The yellow house on the corner. I'll just need to grab my bag.
Davy hopped off and ran up the wooden steps of a farmer's porch to what was probably a small hotel 100 years ago. After a minute, he bounded down the stairs, tossed a plump backpack onto the pile of wood chips, and climbed back aboard. Martin was pouring another scoop of chips into the gasifier. He scrambled to keep his footing and held onto the railing as Charles accelerated away impatiently. Davy steadied himself with the railing, too.
Yeah, I told him to radio Leo and tell him I was going up to Concord today instead. I bet he'll be full of questions.
Ah, speaking of Leo, said Martin, I thought you two were heading up security or policing or something in Manchester. Well, what are you doing way out here?
Oh, sure. Leo's still Mr. Law and Order. But to tell you the truth, he's kind of got it covered. Gang trouble really slacked off after winter and spring. The West Side is still controlled by Vaquero, but he's turning out to be more of a mayor than a gang boss. The city's big problem has been clean drinking water. People have been dumping their sewage into the river, or into the streets even, hoping that the rain will wash it away, which it doesn't. Cholera and other fevers keep breaking out all over the place. Clean drinking water is near impossible to find. The mayor and city council have been working on cleaning things up. The poop bucket program is working okay-ish. The what? Martin interrupted. Huh? Sorry. I just kind of figured everyone knew, said Davy.
Well, I don't have much reason to go into Manchester, Martin said. I heard it really stinks lately, and now I know why.
Well, that's part of what the poop bucket program is supposed to help fix. It's got a fancier name, but it still amounts to collecting buckets of poop. Instead of dumping their waste in the street, hoping it'll wash downhill into the river, the program asks people to put their poop and pee in buckets at the curb. Workers gather them up in the morning, haul them to the lagoons east of town, and dump them in. The lagoons have been filling up, so they're trying to get farmers to take the sludge for fertilizer. That's gross work, so it's not easy to recruit for, as you might expect. They've only got about half the workers that they need to really cover the city, so some people are still dumping in the streets, creeks, or in the river.
Okay, but that didn't answer my question, said Martin. Why are you way out here?
Oh, yeah, that. So, Leo says to me one day that we got the crime and gang thing pretty much under control, and I say, yeah, we kind of do. Then he says, maybe I should do something else important for enforcement. And of course, being an idiot, I said, well, yeah, I should. So he put me in charge of cleaning out and cleaning up the watershed around Indian Lakes. Do you know how big the watershed actually is? I didn't either. It's not just the land around the shores. Oh, no. Goes up Maple Creek to Long Pond, then Moose Creek, and that swamp all the way up to Three Ponds. But why? Well, the lakes used to be Manchester's fresh water source, before the grid went down, you see. With no pumps, there was no more city water. People were drinking whatever they could get. Streams, ponds, rivers. In the cold winter, it didn't seem too bad. So much was frozen. People melted snow. Yeah, but come spring, just about everything was getting contaminated. People started getting sick. City Council wanted to get clean drinking water flowing again. They got a stationary steam engine thing rigged up at the Cohos Brook pumping station. I mean, pipes is pipes, right? It's the electric pumps that the grid took down. But before they start pumping water up into the reservoir on Oak Hill, they want the water to be clean. That meant cleaning out all the squatters who were camping around the lakes. Can't have people pooping and peeing in the city's drinking water. The squatters are all gone, but we got to keep after the residents now. They can't just go dumping their septic sludge wherever they want anymore. Inside the watershed, it washes into the lakes eventually.
Martin dropped two scoops of chips into the gasifier and watched the little trailer gently wagging a little from side to side, like the tail of a contented but sleepy dog.
Martin, why do you guys head it up to Lincoln for? What's up there?
Well, it's kind of a long story, but we're going up to do some welding for a guy named Farnham, who plans to run a steam train from Lincoln to Manchester and back.
Wait, I heard of that guy, said Davy. He was recruiting workers in Manchester to move some rails and make some new sidings over by the canal. He was calling it his new trade terminal, or something. He must have been offering some good pay. He had quite a crew working over there. It's hard to find anyone to work on anything nowadays.
Why? Are they all sick? Martin asked.
Well, there's that. There's work to do, work for food, etc. But not enough able bodies to do all that needs done. It doesn't help that nobody can compete with Farnham for wages.
He was pretty generous about hiring us, too. He's pretty certain his railroad will be a big deal for New Hampshire.
Oh, yeah, he's got plans, all right, added Davy. I heard he was trying to talk the mayor into letting him tap into some power from the dam turbine, assuming that they ever get that working again, and assuming that Vaquero lets the work proceed.
Yeah, he mentioned the hydro dam to me, too, said Martin. Something about needing machines to repair the locomotive when it...
Hold on!
The truck tilted to the left as Charles turned hard right. The little trailer got up on its left set of wheels for a moment before clanking down on all four. Martin called down,
Hey, not so fast on the turns, Charles. You got a trailer back here, remember?
A glance to the left revealed the reason for the sudden turn. The Hooksett Bridge was blocked again. They would have to go up through the small towns of Suncook and Pembroke to get to Concord.
Ah, so you guys are going up to work for this Farnham, too? Asked Davy.
Oh, yeah, a couple of days of welding for some stuff. We don't really know what we'll be doing until we get up there.
Yeah, you really think he's going to get that train thing running? Asked Davy.
No, interjected Tyler, without looking over.
Well, we're not totally convinced, but there's a chance that it might, added Martin. If it does, it's great for everyone, and we stand to benefit.
And if it's all a boondoggle, snipped Tyler, then we've wasted 2 or 3 days that we'll never get back.
Well, yes. Let's just say we're not all convinced, yet. So, Davy, you're supposed to be clearing out Indian Lakes. Why are you going up to Concord?
Ah, the governor wants to try to get the other towns to clean up their waste, too. Concord's starting to stink like Manchester, and it's upriver from Manchester. They've got the same sort of problem with their water source, Lake Penacook. I'm supposed to give a talk on our Brownout to Clean Up Manchester program. Bokum. That's the official name for the poop buckets. Yeah, I told you it was a dumb name, so I just keep calling it poop buckets. Everybody knows what you're talking about.
The landscape through Pembroke was similar to what Martin had seen on their trip down to Atkinson. Yards had become gardens. Wider open spaces looked like a close-up of green corduroy, with rows of low, bushy crops. The scene opened up from a narrow, tree-lined highway to a treeless expanse of empty parking lots studded with light poles. Low commercial buildings sat behind their empty parking lots. Charles slowed down the truck to a more maneuverable speed, should he need to turn quickly. The wide open view was reassuring in a way, but it also felt very exposed. Both Martin and Tyler studied the abandoned buildings for any sign of movement.
Yeah, well, I can understand you guys being careful, said Davy. Yeah, but this section's been cleaned out and empty since last winter. Yeah, nothing left here to steal, and no good for living in. Nothing but ghost plazas.
Thanks, replied Tyler, but we'll keep an eye peeled anyhow.
There was no signs of life. The truck rumbled down the empty highway. The engine's clatter echoed back at them from off the flat fronts of the abandoned car dealerships, tire shops, and furniture stores. The brightly colored but broken store signs seemed like the voices of ghosts beckoning non-existent drivers to turn in and check out the latest sale. For a moment, it struck Martin as being like the remnants of an aqueduct or an isolated row of marble columns, suggesting a once vibrant Roman Empire that had once been there. These abandoned stores were the ruins of a, well, now bygone era when factories produced more goods than people could buy, and that era's people had so much excess income that they could waste it on frivolous goods and impulsive purchases. It was a very different world now. Even when the power would eventually be restored, would life ever return to that fast and wasteful pace? Would children grow up during this outage and its normalized austerity, point to the modern ruins and ask their fathers what clearance sale meant? The parking lots were already sprouting tall grass from many cracks. They could become stony meadows in just a few years. Fast-growing birch, poplar, and red maple trees would quickly colonize the soil that drifted against the buildings. They would grow up to envelop the facades like Mayan temples in the jungle. Would the empty hulks of big-box stores appear to those children as more part of the landscape than part of civilization? Davy spoke up, interrupting Martin's archaeological daydreams.
Yeah, keep going under the bridge, he said. Follow Route 3 into town. Turn left at the State House.
As the low commercial buildings transitioned into the 3- and 4-story brick buildings of the old downtown, the fetid smell of aged human waste began to grow. Civilization was there. There was no visible sludge in the gutters of Main Street, but the problem couldn't have been far away. Nearing the State House, there were more pedestrians. They walked briskly to get where they were going, with no lingering.
"Anywhere in front of," began Davy. "No, wait, over there. See those two guys in blue shirts? Over there. One of them is the guy I'm supposed to meet."
As the truck rolled up the street, valve clatter echoed off the brick walls. The two men stopped their conversation to gawk at the spectacle. Davy hopped off the back of the truck as it pulled up to the curb.
"Davy Walsh," exclaimed the taller of the two men, "you're a day early."
"I know. Better than horseback." Davy gestured with a thumb over his shoulder. "They were on their way up to Lincoln, so I hitched a ride."
"Lincoln?" asked the shorter man. "How are they going to get past Plymouth?"
"Plymouth? Why?"
Charles was starting to pull away when Martin bent down to call through the open window.
Hold on, Charles. It sounds like there might be a problem."
"We don't have time for problems. All these detours and delays cost us time. We're supposed to be up there by 8, and it ain't gonna happen now."
"I know, but trouble could slow us down even more. That guy said something about trouble at Plymouth."
Martin straightened up and called to the shorter man.
"Hi, what did you mean about Plymouth?"
You guys weren't planning to go up 93, were you?"
asked the man. Well, yeah, we were. Why?"
The man shook his head.
"Yeah, they've had 93 blocked off for months now. Even the guardsmen don't go up 93 anymore. Too much trouble."
"Well, who's got it blocked off?" asked Tyler.
I forgot what they call themselves," said the man.
He looked to his companion for the name, but the man shook his head and shrugged.
There's got to be hundreds of them. Lay claim to Plymouth and lands around it. They won't let anyone go past without paying some humongous bill."
They call it the guilt fee or something,"
chimed in his companion.
Yeah, I heard that too," said the shorter man. "The governor wants the guard to put the stop to it all, but they're too short-handed."
"What?"
Tyler's voice rose in outrage. He jumped down and stomped over to the driver's side of the truck. The brothers resumed their earlier argument, refueled with the Plymouth revelation. Tyler demanded that the project be abandoned, with accusations of his brother's habitual irresponsibility. The latter point was peppered with examples reaching back into childhood. Charles, on the defensive, insisted that the project was worth the effort, and that there had to be a way to get through since Farnham had driven his buggy down through that area and spoke so calmly of returning, so there must be a way. Charles peppered his rebuttal with examples of past opportunities his brother missed because of his overcautiousness. A few of those from Tyler's childhood. Martin rubbed his temples and wondered what he had gotten himself mired into this time.
Is that railroad project likely to be a source of gain for Martin and the Hendrick brothers? Or will it turn out to be a total waste of time? A boondoggle, as Tyler put it. In a grid-up world, the infrastructure and systems provide a rather robust safety net, if you think about it. You can try different things to improve your situation, and if they fail, you usually don't crash and burn. You could, for instance, try making homemade pet beds or clever birdhouses or weaving decorative baskets, and if it turns out that they don't sell, and you can't make a living off of it, you'd probably still have your day job, and you'd be okay to try something else. But in a grid-down world, the safety nets are gone. You don't have that regular day job to provide the baseline of food and shelter, etc. You'd be far busier than you were before just trying to do those basic needs. There wouldn't be much free time to invest in possible improvements. If you did have some free time to invest, you wouldn't have much beyond your gut instinct to gauge whether the venture would be beneficial or a waste of time. Time which you really didn't have to waste. In this section of the story, Charles is the optimist who sees potential benefits. Tyler is the pessimist who sees only a waste of time. Martin is someplace in the middle, where most of us would be. Investments have costs. When do you decide the cost outweighs the potential benefits? It's seldom easy to tell. In podcast news, the Siege podcast topped 90,000 downloads recently. Thanks, everyone, for your ongoing support of the story. I can see from the stats that there are still a few new listeners each week, starting in Chapter 1 of Book 1. That's encouraging. I do appreciate the support you listeners have been giving via the virtual coffees at Buy Me a Coffee. Links are in the show notes, as usual. And to you monthly members. Did you monthly members see the recently posted preview chapter of Book 6? What did you think? Coming up next week will be the next in our Doom episodes. This time, Enviro-Doom. Global warming is supposed to be an existential threat to us all in just a few years. Fictional Enviro-Doom stories have things go bad rather quickly, but then they kind of have to because the movies are only an hour and a half long, after all. What, if anything, is a prepper to do about environmental doom? Check our next week's episode to see what we thought. Thanks for listening.